This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's really nice to be live with you on the show this morning. I'm actually currently in New York, and at the moment it is just after 4 o'clock in the morning. So a bit of an early start for us over here today. What I really wanted to discuss today was one or two observations that I've made since being here. Just to put in perspective, I've come to New York because my wife is doing a block in university over here over the American summer. And I've come, you know, just to be with her for a little bit over that time. And, you know, I have not been in New York as a holidaymaker, as a guest, I suppose, for quite a while. And, you know, with all the political noise that's been going on and all the economic challenges that seem to have risen during the war in Iran, which has now raised its head again, and the election of a new mayor in New York, I was not quite certain of what I would meet on the ground. There was a lot of hesitation from my side, simply because of the amount of media that I follow and the experience that I've had in New York before. I was quite hesitant to be here, especially to be in an area I'm in an area now called Washington Heights, which is right next to Yeshiva University. Not an area that I was sort of used to being in, simply because there's lots of high rises. It's a very densely populated area. There are not suburbia, so to speak. It's just a lot of different concerns that I had coming in. The other concern that I had was the time of the year. It's the summer. And, it's well known in America that during the summer, the big cities tend to empty out and people go upstate into what they call the mountains, the areas known as the Catskills. And the whole community sort of move up there. And I was just interested to see how all this works. So I'm going to put it in perspective for you this morning, a few of the observations that I've made, a few of the stereotypes that I have experienced and broken through my day-to-day interaction over here, and just my feelings of what's going on over here, being on the ground. And why I feel that is so important is that as a South African who lives in Israel, again, one is exposed to a certain amount of media. One hears stories and one reads reports from what's going on in South Africa. I've just listened to the news now, and you get a feel as to what's happening on the ground. But when I'm in South Africa, which I'm there often, one gets a different perspective of the one that you get from hearing the news. And the reality is, if I give it from a South African perspective, nothing has really changed in the last couple of years. Every time I'm there, it's just a sense of familiarity. It's a sense of the ease of operating, the ease of getting on with your day-to-day life. Yes, there is traffic and there are challenges, but the reality is that if you live within the communities that I've always lived in, and you work in Sandton, life goes on as per normal, so to speak. Traveling to Eastern Transvaal and Mpumalanga, those areas, the roads work, everything's up operating. It's just a sense that things go on as per normal. And yet, unfortunately, the news does often portray it as something that's, you know, quite dysfunctional. But yet, if you just scratch below the surface, and all you need to do that is to speak to a visitor, you'll get a totally different perspective. So let's take a quick break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. It's 11 minutes past 10. And yes, I forgot to mention that we have moved our slot from 11 to 10. So I've gone from 12 to 11 to 10. I really hope I don't get put in the early morning slot, because that's not the slot I'd like to be in. But this is where I am at the moment. So as I was saying, if you just want to get a perspective, speak to a tourist, somebody who has not been there before, and all of a sudden you'll realize that in South Africa, I was there a couple of weeks ago, went for runs in the morning, and recognized that the same sort of manholes are missing that were missing 5 years ago. And I knew exactly where they were because nothing's really changed. And I'm just giving that perspective, not as a criticism, just at the reality on the ground, because coming to New York and spending time here, not as a student, not working in the city as such, but I suppose really just being a tourist and having time in the afternoon, because it's already late in South Africa to go around and see things. The perspective is quite interesting. So just first of all, the perspective of getting around and the transport system over here, I was very hesitant to go on the subways and travel around. And it was my wife who pushed me to say that all her colleagues do it every single day. We just have we're lucky enough to find an apartment two, three blocks away from the university for the summer. But a lot of her friends, and a lot of them are from Israel, so she knows them from the university over there, travel in from Teaneck, which is in New Jersey, the adjoining state, or get around from different parts of New York, and they use the subway system all the time. Now, when I was here in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the subway system was rough. Every train was graffitied. It was filthy. It really wasn't a pleasant place to be. It worked. And then when I came back many years later, in early 2000s, 2010, I was pleasantly surprised. That was after the Giuliani years, where the trains were pristine and they were silver and they were clean and the stations were clean and there were people walking around to assist. And was a very efficient system. It's still an underground. It still has its own sort of character, but it was a real, a really different experience to what I'd seen years before, and I wondered what I'd see now. And the reality is, it's exactly as it was prior to this: clean, neat, efficient. The subways are grubby from time to time, but on the whole, people just get on. People do their thing. I was very concerned about phone, wallet, watch, all these sort of things. Everybody's on their phone all the time, whether you're walking down or walking up from the subway, whether you're waiting on the platform, whether you're on the train, everybody's on the phone, and it's really not a hassle. There is quite a noticeable police presence, which is quite nice to see. Our first experience was that we arrived at the first station, my wife and I, and we just watched some of the bollard in the front in order to get onto the platform. And we thought that would be the norm, but it hasn't been. I've traveled up and down, and it's really efficient. It works very, very well. The days of carrying a map are over, even though I did ask for a map and I was given one. I like to see a piece of paper in front of me, but you can use your Move It app, which is the same transport app that you would use in Israel, you can use here in New York. I use chat just to get an idea of to which stations to go to and where to switch. And it was very, very efficient. So, yeah, just to give you an idea that getting around New York's always like it has been, and it's been quite efficient and quite pleasant. The last thing that I'd like to share with you is stereotypes. Statements that are made sometimes, which makes people uncomfortable, comments that are made that can be seen as derogatory, but a certain practice that has become generational, which is something that is accepted in certain parts, I suppose, of the city, which is Manhattan, which are, to me, bizarre. And which I think in other parts of the country and maybe even different parts of the city of Manhattan itself be totally unacceptable. And that is this practice of opening up the fire hydrants. So you have many, many, many fire hydrants all over the city on every block. They thick black poles that come out of the ground about a meter high with a big silver cap on the top. And somehow, if you have the right equipment, you can jimmy it so that you get the spray of water that comes out. And what people do is they open these fire hydrants, and not one or two, but one a block, and they let the water spritz out. That's about the best expression I can use to describe it. And you've just got the spray of water going across the road, and then it forms a bit of a pool on, you know, in the gutter. And people take their chairs and they just sit on the sidewalk and they sit in the spray of this water, and that's totally acceptable. Now, being South African, where you were taught from day one that water is precious and you don't waste it, you know, the first difference you'll see is when you wash something in a sink in South Africa, you'll turn the water on, you'll wash it, you'll soap it. And when you're not actually using the water, you turn it off and then you turn it back on when you need it. It doesn't work like that here in the States, or specifically in New York. You turn on the tap, the faucet, as they call it, and just let the water run. And you turn it off when you finish the whole exercise, which is something strange because, again, it shows that there's no lack of water and it's not a scarce resource and people don't feel that wasting it is a problem. And obviously, there's very little cost to doing that. Otherwise, there would be consequence to wasting it. But just this idea that these fire hydrants are opened and the water is just spritzing all over the show, and people are sitting around outside on the pavement, just sitting there, is something that's really, really strange to see. But this is something that I remember from 30 years ago, if not more. I remember hearing about it. And now I'm seeing and experiencing it as I suppose, a mature adult. And the practice is a bit strange. But let's take a quick break. And I've done some research. And when I come back, I'll unpack why that happens and why it's done, which is something that is very interesting. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. It is 21 minutes past 10. And first of all, kol hakavod to Atzala once again for the initiation of an incredible project. There are so many people out there that need to just speak to someone. And there are so many people out there that don't realize how urgently they need to speak to somebody. If you're feeling down, if you're feeling overwhelmed, if you are having challenges at home and at work, or either or, because of the pressures that you feel on a daily basis and that it's affecting the way you operate on an ongoing basis, please pick up the phone, call Atzala, and talk to them. It is so important that you're able to get help, that the community is there for you in this particular way. You'll never know where it might go. You never know what type of reaction you might get by just being able to speak to someone anonymously in a non-judgmental way and help you to get through a certain challenge. So please take advantage of that. So coming back to the strange, interesting, maybe bizarre behavior of opening the fire hydrants and just sitting on the pavements, it is seen through my jaundiced lenses, coming from South Africa, from Johannesburg, coming from Modi in Israel and seeing this. But yet, when you take a step back and talk to myself, stop being so judgmental at something that looks unusual and strange, and you just maybe look at it a little bit more, talk, discuss, try, understand, all of a sudden, a whole world is open for you that you don't know about and you don't experience. First of all, it's interesting that judging is just a natural human instinct. Instead of standing back and looking and asking why, how does it work? So from the research that I've done, the one thing I noticed is that there's a lot of people in the evenings on the pavements, the sidewalkers that they will call it here. People bring chairs down, people bring down little TV tables, they're playing games, backgammon, checkers, things like that. And then when you walk around the buildings and you go up and down and you see the way buildings are built, the first thing you'll notice is that there are no balconies, or very, very few buildings with balconies. You look up, it's just a concrete block that has windows. Every time you look up, all the windows are closed. So the windows are closed and there's no balconies. The reason for that is because of the weather. The weather is hot, it's humid. Humidity is in the 90s at times. It's in summer, it is really, really unpleasant. And there's nowhere to be outside. So you're inside your apartment with the air condition on, conditions on, no fresh air. If you just want to go and sit outside and chill, we can take it for granted there's no gardens. There's no balcony. There's nowhere to go outside. And the reason there's no balcony from the research that I've done is that a lot of the buildings were built here post-war, post-1940s, and they were built for maximum occupation. They were built to make sure that every square inch of livable area is used effectively. A balcony is a waste of space when it comes to that. People can't live there. It is something that is not that lettable. In other words, people will not necessarily want to pay for the space of a balcony. They want to pay for a space to live in. The other thing that I found very interesting is that the challenge with the balcony is a insurance and a legal one. If you think of most balconies in South Africa, the balconies are not necessarily directly on the pavement. If you take places like Heilbron, CBD, yes, they are. But if you look at Sandton, you look around, there's very few residential areas with balconies that are directly on the pavement. And why is that so important? That's from a safety and a litigious issue. Balconies, things can fall off, railings can break, people can maliciously throw things over and hurt people down below walking up and down on the balconies. The laws in New York are such that that is a very onerous thing, and therefore having balconies is a whole nother science of architecture and engineering on its own. You need to make sure that the railings are safe, they're inspected on an ongoing basis, which is an expense and onerous for the building owners. And it's also a space that, as I mentioned earlier, is not lettable as such. People are paying for a space that is a luxury rather than a space that they can actually live in. And again, yesterday afternoon, went for a walk around the area. I saw one building with balconies. The rest don't have them. And therefore, if you are coming home from work in the afternoon and you just want to sit down and chill and take it easy and be in outside, so to speak, the only place to sit is on the pavements. And therefore, it becomes acceptable to do that. And that's a whole subculture. And once I realized that, and I was walking back from being out yesterday afternoon and coming back, I just looked around and looked at it through a different lens. And there's just family sitting, generation sitting. I saw a young kid sitting in his grandfather's lap. I saw people sitting outside a store playing games. And all of a sudden, you just realize it's part of a different way of operating simply because there isn't outdoor space to sit in. What there are beautiful parks, and the park's not used in that sense. People don't sit in the parks, people don't use the outdoor areas like that. From my observation, what is heavily used is the sports areas around the parks. So around the parks is basketball courts, and there's different sort of sports areas that are very, very well used. And that's really nice to see them used both in the evening and during the day, obviously less, but there are facilities like that. So when you take all of that into perspective, you're living in a concrete jungle, and the only place to really be is outside. It's really hot. It's not like most South Africans can do, come home from work, jump in the pool, sit on the patio, sit in the garden, complain that the lawn hasn't been mowed or that they need to mow the lawn. It's a totally different way of operating, and once you see it through those type through that lens, all of a sudden you realize that it's so easy to look at something and say that looks strange. But if I lived here, I suppose I would do, I don't know if I would sit on the pavement, but my wife and I definitely go for a walk in the evening, and we walk through the forested areas, but yet we walk around also and just get out, because otherwise you're sitting in an air-conditioned room all the time. Right, let's take a trip up north. If you go up to the mountains, what is the practice here? The practice here in America, in Israel, is that the summers don't work like they work in South Africa. South Africa, we all know, is you have your December holiday from about the 14th of December. Everything sort of shuts down till early January. And then we have a bit of a break somewhere in the winter, June, July, depending on what happens. We have more public holidays than we can count, which often turn into long weekends. And we also have the ability just to take off a Friday, or in a summer to leave early on a Friday and even go as far as the Kruger, which can be 4 hours from Johannesburg, maybe 3.5 hours from Pretoria, and or go to other areas and just really have a lot of our time that is relatively close to the big urban areas. Over here, people go upstate, they go up to upstate New York, where the area is very similar, I suppose, if you want to compare it to what you expect to find in Mpumalanga, in the Hazy View, White River area, very forested, but it is on a totally different scale. The waterways are massive. You know, we cross a big river in South Africa, and before you blink, you're over the bridge. Here, the bridge goes on. I mean, it's really very, very wide, vast expanses of water. And you get up to the country and you just surrounded by forests, beautiful, quaint little areas. And the three or four observations that I'd like to make of this. Number one, the availability of kosher, the availability to be able to go up to these areas and not pack a thing is absolutely phenomenal. You'll be driving down a road which seems to be just really country, chilled, not expecting to see kosher delight as you drove past. And there's a big store that only sells kosher food. I saw one or two stores which has big posters hung outside, which I got the feeling that maybe they were sort of turned into a kosher store over this period of time. But even if you go to the biggest stores like Walmart and you walk around, you could think you're in one of the very Jewish areas in New York, because 50%, if not more, of the people walking around are clearly Jewish and are clearly there for the summer. And then you're driving around and all of a sudden you'll see what they call a bungalow colony. And a bungalow colony, I can best describe it, as a friend said to us last Friday, is if you think of Dirty Dancing. If those of you watched the movie and maybe watched it more than once, that colony of people living in little, what they call bungalows, we'd call them, I suppose, also bungalows, little huts, not huts, that's the wrong term, but little cabins, that's the right term. And people getting together communally in the evening, or having more of a kibbutz sort of vibe. That's exactly what these bungalow colonies are. And we were invited to friends of ours that live with us in Modi'in in Israel. They go to a bungalow colony they've been going to since their kids were born. So that's 20 plus years. And on the one wall in their bungalow, they've got pictures of every single year. And as we know the kids well, you can just see from little babies to kids to teenagers to young adults as they've been coming to this bungalow colony. And our friend described it that they would arrive, that car doors would open, the kids would jump out, and they would not see their kids until evening. So even though they were part of, the kids are not part of a camp as such, which you can also do, and I'll discuss that and the cost of that in a moment. They arrived in this bungalow colony, and the kids just knew the kids. It was the same people every year, with twists here and there, I suppose. But the idea that the kids just were able to be free and run around and not have to worry about a thing is absolutely phenomenal. It's just an incredible way to grow up. We then took a walk, and he showed us where the shul was and the different minyanim that happened at different times. And he explained to us that they, as what we would, consider modern Orthodox, are in this bungalow colony where a lot of people are more ultra-Orthodox these days. And yet everybody just gets on, and it's just a very comfortable way of spending the summer. So the idea is with this particular family that he still works during the summer. So he goes into Manhattan on a Monday morning, and he comes back. It used to be on a Friday morning. Now it's more on a Wednesday, as is a little bit more senior. And she's very happy to be by herself in that sense. Got friends, never eats supper alone. He has the ability to go for runs and walks and just enjoy the beautiful area. We went for a paddle in a canoe on the lake, and just again explained to us that this is the lake that his kids have been canoeing in for the last 20 years, and explained how they built this jetty and how they stock it with fish at the beginning of summer every year, so that people can come out and fish and enjoy it. And it's a whole different experience. And this is how they spend their summer. What I found fascinating is that if you look at their home in Israel, it's just a beautifully run home. The actual structure is the building is aesthetically pleasing. It's just a nice place. And yet their bungalow is very, very, very modest, to say the least. One bathroom, very small, a central area with rooms leading off it. Accommodation that I don't think the average South African would pay for to use on a weekend if they went away. The most simple accommodation in Kruger, for example, is streets ahead of where this is. This has been the same accommodation for the last 20 years, with maintenance just to keep it from falling apart, I suppose. And yet there's just such a sense of tranquility, a sense of being happy, a sense of being content. And she looked at us and just said, "This is surprising, isn't it?" I said, "To be honest, yes, it is. It's not what I expected." She says, "But now you can maybe understand why we come back year after year after year. And now that even our kids are older and they don't come with us anymore, we still come back, because at that pole in the middle of the circle where all the bungalows are, that's where we have a kiddush on a Shabbat at about 12:30. And everybody brings stuff together. Shlishis at 6:30, 7 o'clock, everybody gets together on a Shabbat. Just I never need to worry for anything, whether my husband's here or not here. I'm perfectly safe. I'm just surrounded by people. And yet, if I want to, there's a shop up the road that I can even walk to and get what I want." So that to me was a really interesting perspective, because we've heard about, a family say, "Oh, my parents have a house in the country or upstate," or this or that, and what it really means. And people have these homes. There's a difference between having a home that you can use in the summer and having a home that you can use all year round, because the home needs to be what they call winterfied. The winters there are not like the winters in South Africa, where you're cold both inside and outside, but you can manage. When it gets really, really cold and there's snow and ice, you need to have a home that can be heated and is designed to withstand the winter. So as she said to us, their bungalow can only be used from Shavuot to Rosh Hashanah. It was interesting the way she put it, its perspective of the Jewish holidays. And that's that is really my observation of living in a bungalow colony. Let's take a quick break. And when I come back, I want to look at the cost of sending your kids to camp in America and what that's all about. We'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. This is Avi on Money Show, and it is 22:11. Right, coming back to my observations with this about a summer here in New York City, and the idea about going to camp. So the concept is that you have bungalow colonies, so to speak, and people who are fortunate enough to be able to have a place that they can go away, like friends of ours, and their children don't need to go to camp as such, because they can just go there and spend a summer there, and there's always so much to do. The majority of people need to be able to send the kids away. So in America, you have this very, very long summer that starts in July, June, July, and goes all the way through to the end of August. And basically, it starts at the, it ends at the beginning of Elul, and it's a long period of time, and it's in unknowns in Israel. It is a major challenge for parents, because your child is unsupervised for a long period of time. Again, if you have the means and you can send your child to camp, great. But if you don't have the means, it means that your child wakes up in the morning with nothing to do for a long period of time. It's not a week or two, it is a month or two. The challenges are that parents are working, kids are left to their own devices. I know in Israel, and I can speak more specifically for Modi'in, there is a lot of stuff that is put on by the city. The city organizes events on a daily basis. So if your child is tuned into that and you're comfortable with your child being involved in that, it's a really nice way to keep the child busy. A lot of kids come up with innovative ideas, run their own little camps, run their own little activities, volunteer, do different things. But it is a long time. But if you send your kid to camp, your child to camp in America, you either would send them for what they call 1 month or 2 months, or the first part and the second part. But they run from day camps. So if you live in certain areas, there are camps that your kid can start at 9 and finish at about 3, and they include a lunch, and they include activities, and they include outings from time to time. Or you can send your kid away to camp, which means that they are in a fixed environment, a environment, something similar to what we would know as Habonim or Bnei Akiva, where your kid goes away to the particular area. And what is the cost? The cost is somewhere between $2,000 and $13,000 US dollars. So a day camp is between $2,000 and $6,000 for the summer. To put it in perspective, so that's where the child would go in the morning and come back in the evening. And then there would be family time, so to speak, in the afternoon. And then the sleepaway camps are anything from $7,000 to $13,000. And that is over and above. You would still then have to pay, obviously, for spending money, snacks. Kids don't necessarily need a lot of spending money, but if they want to have snacks and buy the odd cold drink or be able to do things like that, that's what that would cost. So I've actually gone and done some research. So, for example, if you look at something in the 26 days camp called Young Judea Sprout Lake, that is upstate, that's about $7,800. If you want to look for another one for 3 weeks, that's also about $7,100. That's called Camp Zeke. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. That's what it's all about. So you're looking at a substantial amount of money, bearing in mind that $13,000 is the amount that it would cost a large family in America to live on a monthly basis. So it is a significant amount of money. There are grants and there are monies that are available to help kids go to camp. And every different stream sort of has its own coupa, its own fund to help kids. But what I found interesting is that I picked up a little booklet that was I found in the Jewish bookstore about halachot, the customs and the laws about holiday in this time of the year. For those of you who are not aware of what I'm talking about, Jewish law doesn't change. And whether you're going about your daily life on an ongoing basis or you're going on holiday, a lot of the religious leaders are really at pains to say that, just because you're changing environment, it doesn't change the way one conducts themselves. And these things have been coming out for years. I know when I was chairman in a shul in South Africa, we would put out things like this in December, not as a guideline as to how people should behave, but just to remind people of the challenges of going to a rented place as far as the kosher kitchen is concerned, as far as what products are available, remind them that the US has a website that they can go on that is, very broad. People tend to forget these things because they don't use them on a daily basis. But I found a very interesting article over there. And that article was about charity. And this particular rabbi was writing about the challenge that he has where so many families aren't able to afford to send their child to summer camp. And his observation was that sending a child to summer camp is not a luxury. Sending a child to summer camp is almost a necessity for a typical New York family. The reason being, he stated the obvious. Number one, the danger of the child being left alone to their own devices for an extended period of time. Parents are working, the child's out by themselves. And here I'm talking children from young teenagers, 11, 12, all the way till, they're a lot older, but also younger kids from age 6 or 7 onwards, really being left alone. So just he says that the idea that charity is for important and crucial things extends to this. And he was at great pains to elaborate the concept that looking after a family, to making sure that they are fed and clothed and housed, is on the same level as making sure that the children are not walking around the streets aimlessly, looking for something to do simply because that is the milieu and the environment that they have unfortunately been landed in. And he was really encouraging people to make sure that they reach out to organizations that can help them send the kids to camp. And he was appealing to people who are of means to make sure that they fund these organizations to make sure that people and kids are out there, are able to go. What I then did is I also wanted to take a quick look at comparing the cost of American camps to the cost of South African camps. But we need to take a quick break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. It is 10 minutes to 11. And just to end off with, first of all, thank you for the messages that are coming through. I wasn't quite sure how this would be received because it's not a business show as such, it's just my observations being here. So thank you for the positive feedback. Camp here in South Africa, not camp in South Africa, rather, which runs early December, usually the 4th to the 22nd of December, is round about 15,000 rand, which is significantly less if you take it on a parity to what camp costs in America. One can say, yes, they're not in structured buildings and it's more intense. that's irrelevant. The bottom line is that the grounds need to be maintained, the food needs to be served, staff need to be paid, security needs to be provided, etc., etc. So the bottom line is that camp in South Africa, whether it's a Boni and Bnei Akiva or anything of the like, is really, really well costed. And is obviously costed for non-profit. It is costed to provide the maximum benefit to the people attending at the lowest possible cost. We also know the model in South Africa is that it is a model of volunteerism, a idea of going to camp as a madrich, as a counselor, is something of honor, something of pride. It's a rite of passage. It is a concept that in certain schools is carried through from year to year and then taken into camp. I remember once being told by a certain principal of a certain Jewish day school that sometimes he feels that school is an extension of camp and the kids sort of roll out of camp into school waiting for the next camp. And smiling because that is, in a way, I can imagine as a principal, a teacher, frustrating, but on the other way, it's a culture that is so healthy and so rich. I remember when my youngest son went into high school in Yeshiva College, we were a little bit concerned how this initiation story works in the school. It was our first child in Yeshiva College, and you know, what was going to happen? And well, we were actually in London at the time, and he received a message from the head boy of that year to say, welcome to high school. This is the dress code. Please come to school a day earlier in full uniform, your blazer, your tie, whatever it is. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to introduce you to your big brother who is a matriculant, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the beginning of the most phenomenal 5 years for our child in Yeshiva College. And the reason I'm mentioning that, because I remember how incredible it was for him to just love going to school, because the matrics were like the guys, they were the oaks. And he then became one of those matrics. He then graduated to become a madrich, a counselor in Bnei Akiva himself. And this culture continued, this idea of being able to give back, the idea of passing it on from the next one generation to the next, the idea that you are there as part of a bigger ecosystem. And the more you give, the more the community receives, which means the more there is for the next generation that you are also part of will be able to benefit from. So, you know, just once again, the observations, how things are totally different in two different countries, and yet they are very similar simply because of who we are. But to end off with, Craig, thank you, is that it is heartwarming for me when you drive around the Catskills and you think you are really in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden on the corner you'll see a Jewish man standing who's clearly Jewish, dressed as if he fell out of Mea Shearim in Yerushalayim. And you just think how proud one is to be Jewish and how proud it is to see somebody who is outwardly not prepared to compromise the way they dress, the way they look, the way they are, even though they are away on holiday out in the mountains. And as a guest, as a visitor seeing this, it was a totally different experience. It was something that I can now relate to a little bit more. And it was really, really great to be there. Craig, as always, thank you for pushing the buttons. Everybody, thank you for listening. Hopefully next week I'll be on the same time zone as you and we'll get back to our normal programming. Thanks so much. Have a great day.